Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The 20th anniversary of the death of JonBenet Ramsey is in December 2016. Stephen Singular's 1999 book about the murder of JonBenet explored the realm of child exploitation and its connection to the crime. In August 2016, Singular released an updated edition of Presumed Guilty, an investigation of the JonBenet Ramsey case, the media, and the culture of pornography on Amazon Kindle. It examines why the case still hasn't been solved and the most important developments over the past 17 years. Stephen will be interviewed by Sharp Entertainment for a Lifetime documentary on the murder to be aired on Saturday evening, November 5th, 2016. This program will immediately follow a Lifetime docudrama on the case. The 1999 examination of the JonBenet Ramsey case was the only book to suggest something other than the two conventional scenarios, that one of the Ramseys killed the child or an intruder did it. Presumed Guilty broadened the discussion to include the involvement of child pornography, child exploitation surrounding the murder. The case remains a world-class conundrum. The murder of JonBenet is the only example in the annals of American homicide where a body and a ransom note were found in the same location. In the world of true crime, there is absolute truth and there is effective truth. Since 1999, enough has happened to give us a much fuller sense of the effective truth of JonBenet's death and a much clearer idea why the case hasn't been solved. The book that we're featuring this evening is Presumed Guilty, an investigation of the JonBenet Ramsey case, the media, and the culture of pornography, with my special guest, journalist and author, Stephen Singular. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Stephen Singular.
Thank you very much for having me, Dan.
Thank you. This is, of course, on everyone's mind. It captivated the world back in 1996, and it seems to have done it again on the 20th anniversary with every television station, network, news magazine, everybody included in this. But you were there back in at that time, and you brought us this book, Presumed Guilty, and now the new edition. I just spoke to you briefly before the program, and I alluded to it in the introduction. Tell us just a little bit. Again, you had mentioned that it wasn't so good for you, but tell us just a little bit before we get right into Presumed Guilty about that interview that I had mentioned in the introduction.
Well, Lifetime did a docudrama, as you say, and then it was followed by a two-hour actual documentary on the case. And there were a few scientific things in that show that I thought were very good that we might touch upon later, but the real thrust of it was that it was about Patsy Ramsey and, you know, was she a killer or a victim? And my whole involvement in this case has been to try and widen it beyond the Ramsey family and beyond the intruder theory. So from my point of view, there was very little new information in that realm that came out of it, and it didn't. I think there's a bigger story here that hasn't been talked about very much. Almost all of these shows, and we've seen, you know, one right after the other since early September, has basically focused on this paradigm that everyone knows. Either the Ramseys did it or an intruder came in the house and did it. And I suggested in the book in 1999 that there's a whole lot of space in between those two things, that it doesn't have to be an either-or situation. And I took quite a bit of heat for that when I did it, and in trying to talk about that child pornography, sort of the underbelly of the child beauty pageant circuit and all of that. The book came out in 1999, just so people know. I was on an MSNBC show not long after it came out in the summer of 99, and I was at a studio in Denver. There was somebody else in Denver who was at another studio who was a columnist for the Denver Post, and he picked up the book and dropped it into a trash can on live national television. I'm not saying that to elicit sympathy. That didn't make any difference to me. But it shows you how difficult back then and to some extent today it has been for people even to consider an alternative idea. And this is an unsolved case. You know, it's not like we have the answers in front of us. So that's just an indication of the difficulty of sort of trying to break through the facade of this case and get underneath the surface.
Now, you talk about early in the book that since 1997, yourself and your wife, Joyce, have been just one piece of a civilian murder investigation that's reached across America and countless people involved. Why has there been this incredible civilian murder investigation?
Well, I think, of course, the rise of the Internet fed that, where you could have, you know, everyone linked through that, and much of the evidence, or at least pieces of the evidence, could come out into the public realm. And starting right in 1997, people were creating websites around this. And as the case continued not to be solved, you know, there was more and more impetus to get more information out there, maybe help law enforcement, or try to do something to penetrate this case. I mean, after all, to repeat myself, it's 20 years later, and in many ways the case itself has never advanced one inch. Now, there are developments around it that have advanced or should have advanced it, but it's just built for people to explore and to get involved in and to offer up their theories and to do all those things. We've been contacted by people from Oregon to Florida, to New York, to Texas. I mean, and internationally, Australia, Europe. So yeah, there is interest in trying to figure out what happened.
Now, throughout this book, unlike some true crime books or most true crime books, you are inextricably involved throughout this entire book, speaking with private investigators, police, the DA, Hunter, the new DA, Garnett, afterwards. So, literally, friends of JonBenet Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey and John Ramsey. So, this incredible access. With that in mind, what is the, when you talk about that gap in between the two scenarios, let's go back right to that December 26th, as you do, to explain what was going on with the scenario of the Boulder Police, the Denver Police Department, the FBI, everybody involved here that created a compromised situation right from the very beginning. As you talk about December 26th, but also talk about the reality of the situation with the police department, the FBI, Denver police, and the DA all at the same time.
Well, it was December 26th, and so that means that it was the holiday season. The Boulder Police Department was understaffed. They get about one murder a year in Boulder, and as police departments will tell you in larger cities, if you don't do homicides very often, you don't do them very well, or kidnappings. Boulder had never seen a case like this that occurred on December 26th. So there weren't as many people there to work it. And everyone knows that mistakes were made at the very beginning. The most outstanding mistake to me is, and I felt that again watching the Lifetime show on Saturday, was that the police searched the house initially, which is what you're supposed to do. Why they would not have gone into every room is an absolute mystery to me, because they did not go into the so-called wine cellar in the basement where the body was found about 6 or 7 hours later. So, you know, if that had happened, you would have had a much more pristine situation there in terms of evidence. People are calling it a crime scene. I'm not going to use that term for reasons that might become clear later on. But so that was one angle of it. The district attorney, Alex Hunter, was in Hawaii when this happened on vacation over the holiday season. So he wasn't there to sort of help manage it, which was another problem. But what, to really go back to what you were saying about my involvement and my wife's involvement, is that in the first weeks of January 1997, which is to say a couple weeks after the body was found, we were invited to go to a television station in Denver where a reporter had told us that a hacker was going to be doing some things on a computer that evening. And so we went there, and everyone has to remember this is early 1997. The internet is quite young. It's very young in terms of law enforcement's sort of understanding how crimes would be committed using the internet, all kinds of crimes. So what we saw that evening was absolutely shocking. This guy took us into child pornography sites, sites where there were video and stills of children who were tied up, children who had things around their wrists, around their necks. As we know, when you look at the crime scene with JonBenet, that's exactly what you saw. You saw something around her neck and her wrist. You saw that she had been strangled. And this was by far the most evocative thing visually that connected to the crime. I mean, and then you had the realization that all of these people who were engaged in these activities were hooked up with one another via the internet. So the chances of getting caught doing it and all of that that had, you know, been relevant to child pornography investigations earlier didn't apply in this realm. The man doing the hacking typed in the word JonBenet. There was a feeding frenzy of people just pouring in saying, I want pictures of her. I want pictures of her that are nude or risque. I want pictures of her when she's dead. I mean, and it was absolutely a revelation to me because I didn't know all of these things that were going on. And these were kids, girls who were 5, 6, 7 years old, the same age as JonBenet. So you sort of file that away and go, well, would there be any connection whatsoever between this death in Boulder and this kind of exploitation through visual images? I just sort of let it ride, you know, right there. But we began talking to pageant mothers at that in this area right after that, and they told us the same story over and over again. And the story was about JonBenet's primary pageant photographer, who they all knew well, they all had long-standing relationships with, and they all thought he was a good guy. In the aftermath of the murder, he called them all up in the middle of the night. He was screaming. He was crying. He was saying, I did not kill JonBenet. I did not kill JonBenet. And nobody could figure out why he was behaving this way because, you know, he wasn't being looked at as a suspect. So we gathered information from the pageant mothers who told us that these pageants did draw in shady characters. There were judges, there were photographers, there were others who were considered dangerous and they should not be there. And in various cases, they were told to leave the premises. I mean, it is sort of a natural magnet for people who are interested in that sort of thing. So we had gathered quite a lot of information and 100 days went by. There was no arrest in the case. Every week, every day on talk radio was there will be an arrest today. One of the Ramseys will be arrested. Nothing happened. So I had observed Alex Hunter, the district attorney, through his various television appearances and all that. And I thought he seemed like an interesting man, like thoughtful and not exactly the image of the hard-nosed district attorney. So I decided to call him, and we had a conversation, and he said, come on into my office, and let's discuss all of this. So I told him the story that I've just laid out here, and I think he was very taken with it and realized that the Boulder police, as most everyone knows, were fixated right on the Ramsey family. And there was this much broader potential criminal area around the child that really wasn't being looked at. He didn't know anything about this photographer. He didn't know what the pageant mothers were saying. He was unaware of that whole thing, and the Boulder police had not really looked into it either. So that was really the starting place of basically asking the question, is this case about something more than a mother killing her child because she wets the bed?
Let's go back just a little bit, and we'll come back to the further examination of this child porn angle and the examinations you do by investigating numerous photographers and other people involved with the pageants themselves. But let's talk about the crime scene itself, because I think a lot of people are really confused as to how you've come to this, if we don't explain this, how you come to this conclusion of this third scenario where it doesn't have to be that the Ramseys were completely guilty, and it doesn't have to be that the intruder was completely guilty with the Ramseys being completely innocent. So tell us what exactly was found at that crime scene that also led, you alluded to a little bit in the terms of the photos that you saw that were related, connected, it seemed, to the kinds of the kind of staging that JonBenet had been posed under. So
you look at the crime scene itself, there's duct tape on the girl's mouth. It cannot be sourced to anything in the house. There's fiber evidence on the body. It can't be sourced to anything in the house. The material in the garage, with the exception of the little wooden handle, can't be sourced. That's a nylon type of twine. Can't be sourced to anything in the house. And then the stun gun marks on her neck, which are very evident. There are pictures of her taken about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Christmas Day, where she's sitting in her living room, and you have a very clear view of that side of her neck. And then if you look at the autopsy photo, which was taken the following day, there are two very prominent burn marks that people who know a lot more about this than I do have identified as the result of a stun gun. There's no sourcing of a stun gun in the house. And then you get to the DNA evidence, which has taken a long time to develop and is a story in and of itself. The one piece of information that came out of the Lifetime show in a very clear way for me was that we know that there was DNA left in the child's pants, and that there are a couple of samples of that. The argument against that is that belonging to the perpetrator is that could have just come there in the manufacturing of the underpants. In other words, some worker in Asia just leaves their DNA in there and then you find it. So that's been kicked around a lot. With the development of what they call touch DNA, which is a much more sophisticated form of DNA, which has been developed more in this, you know, after 2000, the articles of clothing were sent to what's called the Bode Laboratory. And using touch DNA, they reasoned that if you took off the child's long johns, not her underpants, but her long johns, that there would be something left around the seam of the long johns on the child. So they looked there and they found several examples of the same DNA. That DNA matches what's in the underpants. The two things were manufactured in different locations. It's all consistent coming from one unidentified male source. I would suggest that's extremely strong evidence of the person who was involved with the child that night, and we don't know who it belongs to, so the perpetrator is unknown. But for me, it was a very clear explanation that you can't simply explain away all of this matching DNA from a manufacturing process, and I thought that was very important. So that's the crime scene that you're looking at. You have a number of things that cannot be tied to anything that's in that house. Then you have the ransom note. And the question I always had was, well, if an intruder did it, very basic question. Why would you leave a body and a ransom note? It just it doesn't make any sense. I mean, you'd leave the ransom note and take the kid, or, you know, if you're going to kill the kid, you probably wouldn't leave a three-page note. So on the surface, what it told me is that this is a more complex case than it's generally being looked at. So, I mean, that's the sort of evidentiary part of it, that that the police and the district attorney's office were confronted with right from the beginning. And that plays out, you know, as the case goes along.
I may be jumping ahead a little bit, but what I thought was very, very, very interesting to me is that there has been so much speculation about this ransom note, and maybe we should talk about the contents of that ransom note, but what I found fascinating was that you state that about some of the contents, or one crucial content, that being that $118,000 bonus. And again, you're not, I'm going to ask you if you conclude something from that, in that Patsy Ramsey did not know of that $118,000 bonus. So could you tell us about the content of the ransom note? Something, I mean, they brought in all kinds of handwriting analysis for this, so...
And again on the Lifetime show, when they showed her handwriting compared to the writing on the note, it really did not look all that similar, and an expert on there said that. Here's the basic thing that I'm suggesting, and to go back to 1996 through 1999, when we were doing this research and involved primarily with the district attorney's office, but also with private investigators and a little bit with the police department, I was suggesting, and I think I'm the only person who was suggesting, that there is something in between the Ramseys being totally guilty or the Ramseys being totally innocent because an intruder did this. Not a popular opinion at that time. In 1998, Alex Hunter asked a grand jury to sit down and look at all of the evidence and hear testimony. The grand jury sat for 13 months. That is an incredibly long period of time for a grand jury to do this kind of work. It's usually 3 or 4 days, you indict somebody, and you move on to the next thing. So that alone was extraordinary. After the 13 months, Alex Hunter came out and said, I'm not going to indict anybody, and I'm going to seal the 18-page document that the grand jury produced. So we didn't know what was in those 18 pages going forward. And my assumption, and I was rather sympathetic to Alex Hunter. I dealt with him quite a lot. But my assumption was he might have or could have made the right decision by doing that. So 14 years pass. It's 2013, October 2013. The Boulder Daily Camera sued the district attorney's office. It's now two district attorneys later to get that document released. It's a public document. The public funds it. The public does have the right to know. A judge ordered that four paragraphs out of the 18 pages would be made public, just four paragraphs. Those paragraphs state very clearly that the Ramseys were to be indicted, according to the grand jury, for two things. There are two counts, counts four and count seven. The first one is that they exposed their daughter to the circumstances that led to her death, child endangerment. The second one is that they helped cover up a crime, not for murder. They were not, or the grand jury, which had looked at the evidence for 13 months, did not recommend that they be indicted for murder. So my point is that that is precisely in the middle of total guilt or total innocence. The people who studied the case more than anybody, the people who had access to all the evidence, the people who heard testimony for 13 months, effectively came to the same conclusion that I was talking about in 1999, that there's more here than two options. They gave that to the district attorney, Alex Hunter, and he chose not to take their work and indict the Ramsey parents. Looking back now from 2013, I cannot understand why they were not indicted. What it tells me is that Boulder did not want to open up this case and all of the elements that we've been talking about to public scrutiny, and they just wanted to bury it because the thing was sealed. It was supposed to be sealed forever, and it was only a lawsuit that brought that to light. So now you have four paragraphs saying that both parents were indicted on those, or were recommended to be indicted on those two counts. So here's the next question. What's in the other 14 pages? Is somebody else named in there? Are there other people involved in this? Why wasn't the whole document released? Again, if you just think about it from a common sense perspective, why would you ask a grand jury to go to all that trouble, and then they come back and did exactly what they're supposed to do, and then you bury what they did? I'm suggesting that this is a bigger story than mom killing a kid for wetting the bed. And I think if you look at Boulder's response since then, or in and around the whole thing, you get exactly the same thing. They don't want to prosecute this. They don't want to go forward.
Now, you talk about this cover-up, that it must be a cover-up, and you examine and explore this culture, this pageantry. Again, a little bit of us know a little of the phenomena, but you detail this here. So tell us a little bit what you found about the culture. You talked to a woman that's very, very important in the story, Pam Griffin, and she had worked with JonBenet Ramsey. Her daughter, at 3 years old, had won a pageant herself. So tell us about Pam Griffin and the entire exploration where you talk to photographers and find out about this incredible subculture.
Yes. Pam was very important because Pam was not only a good friend of Patsy's, but sewed JonBenet's pageant dresses. And so she was around them a great deal. And she and Patsy just seemed to get along, really well. So she was, of all the pageant mothers we spoke to, she was by far the most street smart. And she would say things like, I instinctively would never let my daughter be alone with a photographer. All the photographer has to do is say, change from the blue dress into the red dress. While that's going on, take a picture, and you have something you can sell. And believe me, going into that room with that hacker, you totally understood that. There were people offering money for the photographs. There were people offering money for pictures, or offering pictures of their own children in exchange for photographs. And it was this marketplace that was flourishing underground. So she was very important in talking about the kinds of characters who came around the pageant world that they had to get rid of. She had confrontations with several people and told them that, they couldn't be there around the children, and kind of opened up that doorway. And Patsy was confided in her the day after the body was found. It's a very dramatic scene. It's December 27th, 1996. The body was found the day before. The Ramseys were not staying in that house and had to go over and stay with some friends. And Patsy and Pam were together all day long, and Patsy kept saying, why did they do this to my child? Why did they do it to my child as opposed to anyone else? And it was we interviewed Pam 19 years after the initial interview with her, and she was even more revealing about some of the things that were said that day. I'm not at liberty, for a variety of reasons, to talk about that right now, but there is an ongoing investigation into some of that. So she was a very critical person with Patsy at that time. The important part of that is that she was interviewed by the police and by the grand jury. And I don't know what went on in the grand jury because that's secret, but she was interviewed by the police. They never asked her about the pageant world. They never asked her about pedophiles or photographers or any of that. The only thing they were interested in was if Patsy was an abusive mother, and did she abuse her children. And so it was extremely interesting to me that all of this information that we've sort of extracted from her, I think could have been used by the Boulder police to interview a lot of people and to learn a lot more about the culture that JonBenet was operating in. And they never did it. And again, it's the same thing. Let's restrict this to one family, one person, and narrow it down to that. That would be fine if the case had been solved. But obviously the case has never been solved and it's never advanced. And I think if you look at the behavior of Alex Hunter, which I just described, and then in 2008, another district attorney, Mary Lacey, looked at that new DNA evidence that we just talked about, and she publicly cleared the Ramseys of committing the murder. Why is that strange and unusual? The Ramseys were not to be indicted for murder. That was never the charge that was on the table. It amazes me that you can have one show after another on television, as we've seen CBS, all the big names, and they're not talking about what has actually happened here, that the Ramseys were, in fact, indicted for something other than murder or were to be indicted, and that two district attorneys have gone out of their way to bury that, to get rid of it. Why? What's the motivation behind that? I would suggest that there were people in Boulder, some of them in fairly high up places, who were involved in these kinds of illicit activities with children. We know of one or two. We know of someone in particular who was very high up in the Boulder power structure who left town after this case, moved abroad. We know of another gentleman who did the same thing. He didn't leave the country, but he left the state. And there's all kinds of evidence that more was going on around the child and around other children in Boulder involving these kinds of activities. And I think that what happened here is that something went terribly, drastically wrong, and it had to be covered up. And that's exactly what the grand jury said, that the Ramseys participated in the cover-up.
You talk about, again, you had already spoken about this photographer named Simons. There was two photographers in particular that took photos of JonBenet. And you also talk about, and we haven't mentioned, again, it's quite shocking for people to see the sexualization of these children, but also that you talk about there being smile coaches and makeup and push-up bras or to make these children look like they had cleavage. And JonBenet and Patsy, whether Patsy was deluded in her quest to get her daughter to be this Miss America that she never became. You also talk about Patty Griffiths talking, another woman talking about this particular photographer asking for her daughter to pose nude. So
yep.
Tell us a little bit more about,
well,
again, you talked about the culture of these.
Right. There was more than anecdotal evidence that some of the mothers talked about that, you know, if the child is photographed nude, I can promote that child more easily. I can, get her further up the ladder in the pageant world. There were stories about if the mothers would have sex with the photographers, they could promote the kids more. So it was not an entirely innocent environment, and Pam is the one who really laid that out. So, yes, I mean, the children were being sexualized. The children, all the things you talked about, dyed hair, teeth, eyes, push-up bras, the whole bit. And guess who would be attracted to that kind of thing? Well, people who are illicitly attracted for sexual purposes to children. And, again, to sort of point out the obvious here, but it hasn't been obvious in this case, is that there was no criminal history of any kind whatsoever within the Ramsey family. There wasn't one example where somebody came forward and said, I saw Patsy hit JonBenet, I saw Patsy yell at JonBenet or Burke, or anyone in the family. None of it existed. I've written three books about women who've committed murders, and in every case, there's a pathology behind the crime that eventually surfaces in one way or another, and you learn that people are either through, you know, mental problems or pressures of a different kind or whatever, it comes out. There's a logic behind why a woman goes and kills somebody. None of it applies in this case. Absolutely none of it. And so the next question becomes, what is the criminal activity surrounding this case? Where's the natural place to look? And that is in the kinds of people who would be attracted to a child like JonBenet, in the pageant world, in the world of photography, in the world in Boulder where people were doing illicit things with children. There are cases that were prosecuted. There are cases that were not prosecuted around this. There's a whole realm there that has effectively been ignored. And when it came right up to the edge of prosecuting this case and figuring out what happened, which the district attorney had not only the right but the obligation to do, they backed off, they sealed the file, and they said the public has no right to know any of this. The public spent $2 million on the JonBenet Ramsey investigation. That's in the early years. I don't know what it is since then. But in the first 2 to 3 years, I suggest the public has the right to know in this particular case, because I'm suggesting that other children were exposed to the same thing and maybe some of the same people. And that's the real story to me at this point, not so much who killed her. I think the DNA would tell you that. But why can't the case be solved? Why has there been a roadblock every single time someone has tried effectively to you know, penetrate the case and solve it?
Now, with this civilian organization, this investigation that you are a part of, because every time, as you chronicle in the book, every time you go to a private investigator, whether you're invited, you give much more information than you get back. And you ask questions that seem to their response, the response that's elicited seems to be that they really aren't looking at that child pornography angle. They're not looking at anything other than what they were told, it seems, to look for. And then, when, like you say, when it seems like there might be a revelation or a breakthrough, there's silence.
Right.
Tell us how you found out about something that I found was the most horrific part of this book, a thing to imagine, is Mr. White, John Ramsey's friend, the Christmas day that they spend over there, and then the rumor that you hear, the story that you hear about Santa Claus and a special meeting with JonBenet.
Right. They, JonBenet told at least three people that she was to have a secret meeting with a secret Santa Claus on Christmas night. She told a neighbor woman this, and the neighbor woman said to her, JonBenet, you're mistaken. Santa Claus comes on Christmas Eve. Everybody knows that. And JonBenet said, no, it's Christmas night. Now, as we all know, the murder occurs on Christmas night. There's a story where JonBenet and her family are at the White family on Christmas night. And it's at the very end of the book. And JonBenet tells her mother, I'm going to have a meeting with a secret Santa. And Patsy starts to question her about this, and JonBenet runs off and never questions her about that again, because she's dead within the next few hours. So I believe that if you're looking for the source of the unidentified DNA, that this connection to a secret Santa Claus, and again, I want to clarify for people who are familiar with the case, I'm not talking about the Santa Claus who came to the Ramsey's house on December 23rd of that year, Bill McReynolds. That's someone else. He was cleared by the police, and I think he should have been. This is something else. She mentioned this to her mother. She mentioned this to the neighbor woman, and she mentioned it to a third person. And I believe that she was either went from that party to some other location where this crime went down, or perhaps she went home, as the official story is, and then she went somewhere else. I do not believe at all that the Ramses knew what was going on at that level. I do not believe that. I think Patsy, all of her behavior around the pageant stuff is innocent, but it's a type of innocence that can be extremely dangerous. And I think she was exposing her daughter to a lot of people and a lot of things that ultimately were dangerous. And so when people say Patsy Ramsey's guilty, that's what I believe she's guilty of. Pam Griffin was not like that. I won't leave my daughter alone with certain people. I will keep an eagle eye on her at all times. I don't think Patsy operated that way. I think she was naive, she was trusting, and she had been in a pageant world which was probably more innocent when she was involved in it. But this is the 1990s. There's the internet. There's child exploitation. There's an underground worldwide marketplace in this kind of photography, these kinds of images. People are getting involved in this. One of the photographers around Jaminet subsequently said he was approached by child pornographers who wanted to use pictures of those children, you know, to create product, essentially. And by then, one of the things that we heard repeatedly from pageant mothers is that, of course, you can take the head of one of the pretty little girls, you can put it on another body, and you can sell that image. We were told that point blank by people who were involved in this world in the late 90s. So all of this stuff was going on, and it was all swirling around JonBenet and her family. And I believe that someone became aware of her through these circumstances, became, you know, that she was a pretty little girl. She was a natural target for predators. And I believe that she attended some event that went horribly wrong. I think it probably involved prominent people, and it had to be covered up. And again, if you look at what the grand jury concluded, if you look at the language of their conclusion, they're saying the Ramses exposed their daughter to the circumstances that led to her death and participated in a cover-up. And I think that's as close to the truth as we've gotten in the case. As you said at the start of the show, there's absolute truth where we absolutely know what happened, and we don't have that here. And there's effective truth where you can try to, you know, logically and reasonably extrapolate from the circumstances. How did all the evidence get on her body if it's not inside that house? Where did it come from? It had to come from somewhere, right? I mean, why? So, again, if you break it down logically, it's perfectly possible to suggest that she did not die inside that house, that she was not killed by an intruder, and that she was not killed by her parents.
If I go along with that, which I find perfectly reasonable, I also, again, my imagination whirls with this very suspicious photographer crying and contacting all these people and acting very, very guilty, this Simons. And also Mr. White, who Ramsey throws under the bus, but inversely, he won't. He won't speak out against the Ramseys. Acted incredibly suspicious, trying to separate Patsy from Pam. And just incredible behavior. And then they have a falling out, John and Mr. White.
Right.
My imagination runs to taking it far more sinister in that I see a photo session with this slimy Simons and some prominent person, like you say, having some kind of Santa photo fantasy. Whereas I think Patsy Ramsey is conveniently naive, and I think something goes much more than horribly wrong. I think this is, I don't know how much more evil the scenario you can get than Christmas, Santa, and child porn.
Right. And I think what you're describing is exactly what needs to be investigated. And it is exactly what the system has resisted investigating. And I'm not naming names here. I want to be clear about that. But I believe that if the investigation had been opened up into these realms, the case would probably be solved. I believe that if the Ramseys had been indicted on what the grand jury concluded, because there are reasons to believe that the grand jury heard about some of what I'm talking about. There are reasons to believe that, which goes back to that question. What's in the other 14 pages? How did they conclude that the Ramseys exposed their daughter to something if they're not telling us what that something was? I mean, it's a very obvious journalistic question. So this is the road that they absolutely have refused to go down. What's the end result? The case is unsolved. And I think it touched on people inside the Boulder power structure that were absolutely determined that this was not going to come out. And it hasn't come out. So, you know, except in, you know, in examples like this where you really do try to apply investigative journalism to the situation as opposed to just jumping to a conclusion.
You explain in this book, and we haven't talked about this, that we hear numerous stories with this True Murder broadcast about infighting and departments not sharing information, a massive disconnect between agencies. But you explain Boulder's somewhat unique political situation, and you say that it seemed to be that Boulder was trying to really cultivate a certain image and retain that image, even through this JonBenet debacle.
Boulder is extremely image conscious. I mean, anybody who's been there or been around it, I mean, it cultivates, you know, high-mindedness, liberal, affluent, you know, college community to the nth degree. They are very, very image conscious. And there's nothing worse for your image than, you know, a dead child in a dirty basement with a garrote around her neck that nobody can explain and that nobody will help solve. So, yeah, and to go to the disconnect between various police agencies or district attorneys, this is what actually happened when I went to Alex Hunter in the spring of 1997. And I laid out the things that we've been talking about here. And they involved the Internet. They involved images and these things. And he said to me, and I swear this is true, the Boulder police will not investigate any of this, so I think you should go do that. Now, this is the highest legal official in the most prominent case in the history of the state and region suggesting to a journalist that because the police department will not do their work, that someone like myself should go look into that, which would involve breaking the law. Absolutely. I wasn't very internet savvy back then anyway. But that shows you how entangled and screwed up this thing actually was. And it was that way because of the fixation, essentially, of the Boulder Police Department. And that, to me, was the biggest sin in the case. Not that they made mistakes early on, because that happens, and not that their investigation, you know, didn't have flaws in it, but there was this sort of fundamental resistance to opening it up and to looking into the natural criminal realm that this child was exposed to.
You talk about the world and the culture of this child porn in 1997, the internet for general use is just a couple years old. And then, of course, this is, you do an update on the bad news, and you talk about a 2014 Time article about the dark web. So I guess we know that it hasn't gotten better since 97.
It's, you know, law enforcement began to catch up with, in 97, there were 5,000 worldwide child porn sites. By 2000, there were 100,000. So it was growing exponentially. And law enforcement has made some strides to catch up with that, but it just goes further and further underground. Now you have the dark web, bitcoins, and all of that, that angle of this. So I think people just need to be aware that, you know, all of this stuff is out there, just like Pam Griffin said. You have to be street smart and aware that children could be exposed to these things, and it could be very dangerous. And really, that was the sort of the underlying purpose of writing the book. I didn't know what happened, and I didn't, I didn't have many of the answers, and I was involved in a little bit of speculation. But I felt that I think it was one of the first books to talk about this underground criminal realm that was emerging up through the internet, and I thought that was worth writing about anyway, and that people should be aware of that, that images can be used for these purposes. So that's why, you don't, as a true crime writer, no one wants to write a book where you don't have the answers, where you don't really know what happened, and you can tell that story to people. That wasn't possible then. It's still not entirely possible now. But I thought the exposing of this other realm was worthwhile.
This other realm, also, you write about the worldwide events since that time, and you describe, again, the audience can handle that. We're talking about child porn, not to be mistaken for 15-year-olds in a bathing suit. Tell us exactly what this worldwide arrests and what type of pornography is found. You spoke to a group called Enough is Enough. Tell us a little bit.
It's extremely graphic. I mean, just so people are aware. But, I mean, what we saw in 1997 was, children tied up, hanging from the ceiling. Again, you could easily be strangled by something like that if something went wrong. And that's exactly what appears to have happened to JonBenet. You're talking about sex, real-time video of adults having sex with children. You're talking about the most graphic stuff you can imagine. And so, this is, and again, I think part of this story is that this is dark matter. This is dark material. People are uncomfortable with it. That's totally understandable. They want it to be, this case, to be about a mother who, hit her daughter over the head because she wet the bed. There was a scientific explanation on the Lifetime show on Saturday night that showed you why that is not what happened in this case, that the sequence of events was the strangulation because there are defensive wounds on JonBenet, and there were, efforts to get the garrote off her neck by her as she was dying, and the whole scientific scenario is laid out she didn't get whacked over the head, and then the Ramseys created this sexual scenario in the basement. The sequence of events is the other way around, which implies that, she was killed, and then this thing was covered up. So, I understand. I think a lot of my experience in writing about this or trying to shed any light on it at all has been met with resistance because people, this is a tough thing to think about. But it's real, and it's out there. And the purpose of writing the book was to say that this is not the only child involved in this kind of stuff. I'm sure this is not the only child in this area that's been involved in this kind of stuff. And we need to be aware of it. We need to bring awareness to it. And I think if the case were solved, I mean, this is just my opinion, but I think it would help illuminate that. It would make people more aware. And that was really the underlying reason for doing this.
Not to contradict you, but what I found awfully strange was that in light of the JonBenet murder, that the pageant business, the woman said, it didn't affect me at all. In fact, I doubled my business.
I think in some cases that's true. I also think it's been toned down in certain areas. It was here. Now, maybe not the South. The South is a different animal, and we all know that. In this area, it toned down some of the costumes, some of the getting dolled up and all of that. So, yeah, in some ways people were drawn to it because it had so much publicity. But I think it did make, that's from speaking with people like Pam Griffin, I think it sobered up a number of people who were involved in that, and they began to rethink a little bit about what they were doing.
The other thing I found was that you mentioned is that really, it's not really the brightest and the most deviant or horrific people are that are actually arrested. You actually talk about sort of the stupid people getting rounded up only.
In what context, you mean?
In terms of,
I mean,
now you have the dark web.
Yeah.
You have peer-to-peer. So, I mean,
well,
it just seems to me, and you, maybe I'm misinterpreting that comment. But.
No, I one of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation men told me that very early on in the investigation that, you know, the dumb people were getting caught. But, you know, one of the – you always retain details from the research you do, but – I just remember being told that, you know, if you were in, Chicago and I'm in Denver and I wanted to send you an illicit image, I could send it from, you know, Denver to Miami to London to Russia to Japan to you. And it would be, and that would take, you know, something, you know, under probably a couple of seconds. And that would be extremely difficult to track, you know, to figure out what the origin of it was and all of those things. So some really smart people were utilizing the technology in that way. And that's, again, that's what made it such a difficult thing for law enforcement. And, again, that's one of the major things I wanted to write about.
Now, you also just talk about some other people, a gentleman in Denver that was arrested, just an hour outside of Boulder, and he was arrested in a child porn ring. And you tell us a little bit about that and why you included that.
Well,
case.
What happened was that in 2000 and 2001, there were a couple of very, very interesting poems that were written and were sent to a lawyer in Boulder who was a part of the Ramsey case in a kind of tangential way. And I subsequently got the poems, and one of them contained names at the end of the poem. And there were six names. Five of the names were fairly well known to anybody who really knew this world. All of the people appeared to have connections to illicit activity with children. And there was a sixth name of somebody who nobody had ever heard of. I hadn't heard of him, and I didn't know anybody else who had. And this was 2001, and I was very intrigued by that. 5 years later, this individual was arrested on charged with 49 counts of child porn creation and distribution, and went into the legal system in Boulder, and, you know, it was locked up. And so when the third district attorney came in on the case, Stan Garnett, in 2009, I began communicating with him, and I shared this information. And, again, it's a little bit complicated, but what I'm saying is that somebody wrote a poem in 2001 about somebody who would be arrested for crimes in exactly this region. The poems were about child porn and crimes against children. And somebody was arrested for that and put into the system. So the person who wrote the poem knew that about this individual, and this individual turned out to be a perpetrator. I knew who wrote the poems, and I knew about the perpetrator, and I knew that the people doing this were trying to get some information to law enforcement about people involved in these kinds of activities in this region, with a suggestion that this had a definite connection to the JonBenet Ramsey case. And I took it to the police, and they wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. So, in other words, you have a perpetrator of these crimes sitting in the system, in the area. Police's job is to go interview people, learn what they know, learn who they know, learn how they got involved in this. You know, we've all watched the crime shows where you make deals with people based upon the information they give up. They wouldn't do it. Why wouldn't they do it? This is one example. There are numerous examples that I could give you of people who tried to come forward, who tried to talk about these activities, who tried to talk about people in the region who were involved in them. They were serious individuals, and they were completely rebuffed by the Boulder legal system. I can't explain that. The only explanation that you can have for that is that this was something they didn't want to investigate. Again, that would be all right if the crime got solved, if you could look at it and say, well, you know, the mother did do it finally, so we all know that. We don't know anything. The reason we don't know anything is that this has never been properly investigated. And so I can tell you that there are people out there now, civilians or people who have worked in law enforcement before, who are still conducting an investigation into this, and some of them are very good. So the case is not over. This is not the end of the road. If there's a DNA match from those samples that hits the national data bank called CODIS, C-O-D-I-S, if you get a hit on that, then you've got a perpetrator. So it's not over. It's a terribly difficult situation, I think, because there are people in power who don't want it to be solved. And ask yourself why. I mean, it's a very good question. So that's where things stand right now. You know, there may be other chapters.
And you said you will update, so obviously.
Well, that's
still...
why the book was brought out as an e-book and self-published, because now if there are developments, you know, we can update it as it goes along and, you know, bring it right into the present. So I'm hoping very much that there will be new developments and that, you know, we'll do another show sometime where we actually have more information. You know, we need to solve this case.
Absolutely, and I think people demand that, like I say, not just the people of Boulder or surrounding area, but citizens want to see a resolve to this. And thank you very much for this investigation, and it's a fascinating book called Presumed Guilty, an investigation of the JonBenet Ramsey case, the media, and the culture of pornography. Thank you very much, Stephen Singular, for coming on and talking about this evening. It's
Thank been you very much, Dan. I really appreciate you giving me an opportunity to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Stephen, and I hope to talk to you real soon about this particular case. Thank you very
All
much,
right.
And good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.